I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's more bipartisan bread breaking in the Oval Office today. But when Congress returns on Monday, pundits are saying, how long will the honeymoon last? President Bush had lunch with Democrats Harry Reid of Nevada and Dick Durbin of Illinois today. Reid is expected to become the next Senate Majority Leader with Durbin as his deputy. The president hosted Speaker-in-Waiting Nancy Pelosi and Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer yesterday, both sides touting the need for cooperation. But the president is facing some major battles on Capitol Hill when the lame duck Congress returns next week as he pushes for the confirmation of John Bolton to the UN and passage of a law to permit warrantless wiretapping of terrorism suspects. Well, joining us for an end-of-week roundup and a look ahead to next week, Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. And Rick, things have been pretty civil, have they not?
Yeah, they have. Remarkably so, after a campaign where each side was calling each other all sorts of names. There's been a lot of joint efforts at bipartisanship and a lot of kind words for each other. President Bush yesterday calling Nancy Pelosi's elevation historic, mentioning his own daughters, and obviously today following that up with another make-nice meeting with the Senate Democratic leadership.
Well, let's take a look at what lies ahead. The president has asked Congress to pass spending bills, approve a free trade agreement with Vietnam, and a U.S.-India nuclear pact. But let's start, of course, with what seems to be the greatest sign of discord ahead, the John Bolton nomination and also the warrantless wiretapping legislation. Outgoing Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, who was probably the most liberal of Republicans and who is a lame duck, lost his seat. He's vowing to block the Bolton nomination in these last few months that he has. Tell us, first of all, this is not really a Bolton renomination.
Well, Bolton is obviously installed now at the United Nations as a recess appointment. The president had to go around Congress to put him at the United Nations because of a Democratic-led filibuster. It stopped him from getting a permanent post there. And what's going on now is Democrats are still making the same noises, and I think President Bush and his administration knew that they were likely to block it. And Lincoln Chafee's comment, basically what he said yesterday, was the American people have spoken and want a new direction in foreign policy, and John Bolton's the wrong way to go, therefore he's going to block it. This is Democrats are really taken aback by this move because of all of the nice things that the president has said about Democrats in the last few days. This move was pretty confrontational because he and his administration know that Democrats have no intention of allowing this vote to come to the floor.
And can Chafee block it? He is a member of the Foreign Relations Committee. Is his no enough?
Yeah, that will deadlock the committee, assuming all Democrats vote against him, which would, unless they can talk him into doing something, playing some procedural games, and you know, saying that he would agree to allowing it to the floor without a recommendation of the committee, which has happened in the past. Actually, it happened with Bolton the first time around. That's a possibility, but in all likelihood, this would actually stop the from coming to a vote on the floor at all.
Right. Well, I want to take a minute on wiretapping as well, because a Michigan federal judge in August declared the president's warrantless wiretapping program unconstitutional. That ruling was appealed, but a new ruling isn't expected until next year. What are its prospects?
I think very, very doubtful at this point. It's certainly not in the way that it's been written by the administration. The Democrats are going to push for a lot more safeguards. They're going to push for a lot more judicial review, a lot more judicial oversight. We could see an updating of the 1970s era law that governs the court that approves these warrants. But in terms of doing it without a warrant, I think the prospects are very much dimmed by this Democratic takeover of both the House and the Senate.
And Rick, in just the few seconds we have, President also hoping for a quick confirmation of Robert Gates as his new defense secretary. A lot of rumblings about Robert Gates' role in Iran-Contra, but he did make a major mea culpa after that issue. Do you think he'll sail through?
I do think he'll be approved. Democrats, I think another sign of bipartisanship, said they were committed to doing that before they take over the majority in January, so we could have hearings and confirmation later this month or in December. I think, you know, from a Democrat's perspective, they're happy that Rumsfeld is on the way out. They're unlikely to reject a successor. I think they already feel like they have a victory here. And in terms of Mr. Gates, the fact that he was a member of the Baker Hamilton Commission gives him some credibility, and the fact that he hasn't been closely allied with this White House gives him more credibility.
Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, on this Veterans Day, the cost of war for the soldiers, and in this case, a journalist covering them. In December 2003, Time magazine correspondent Michael Weisskopf was embedded with the 1st Armored Division in Iraq. He was there to profile Time's Person of the Year, the American soldier. Weisskopf was riding in the back of an Army Humvee when a grenade landed inside with a thunk. He then did what? Instinctively reached for it to save everyone? Or did he even know what it was in the seconds before it exploded, blowing off his right hand? Michael Weisskopf would spend the next several months recovering, getting used to his prosthetic arm, and trying to figure out if he was a hero. He was the first reporter who was not a soldier to be treated at the Walter Reed Medical Center, where he crossed paths with soldiers who'd also lost limbs. His book, Blood Brothers, Among the Soldiers of Ward 57, details their struggles and his own. And he joins us now from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor. Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Shy a right hand, but otherwise, on the whole, pretty good.
Yeah, it's been 3 years, and we're just wondering, do you still think about it every day, or is your hand, your new hand, at times, you know, second nature, or has that not happened yet? Where are you on that?
Oh, I don't think you ever create second nature with a prosthesis or lose your longing for your natural hand, which really is a remarkable instrument we all take for granted until we lose one. It just opens and closes and turns and twists without even a second thought. And losing one is something that's really a hard road to go down. Mm-hmm. And it really becomes no easier with time.
Well, I'm looking at a passage where you say, I never gave much thought to how a hand worked until I lost it. My fingers always flew into action, each function hardwired in my brain. I knew instinctively everything my right hand could do, from throwing a punch to threading a needle. And later in the book, as you go along your recovery and you are fitted with some of these modern prosthetics, you had to, what, control your muscles to control the prosthetic? And it's just extraordinary. I mean, one false move and suddenly the thing would clench.
It begins with a tiny electrical impulse from your forearm muscles, which is picked up by electrodes in the shell of a prosthesis. That sets off a tiny computer in the hand, and it opens and closes and turns as well. You can revolve 360 degrees if your arm is of a certain length.
So early on, there's a scene where you are driving a car with your new prosthetic and what got anxious, and your hand tightened on the wheel and you couldn't get it off. And
the problem is that, like all muscles, they react to the moment, and if you panic or if you're under stress, they tighten up, and that activates the whole process. And it can be a little dangerous until you're familiar with it.
Right. Well, but that's, you know, way down the road. Along the road to even that place where you had something fitted for your hand, you went through this incredible rehab and were uniquely positioned to see soldiers go through it as well. Can you tell us a little more about the emotional and psychological part of this that you really needed to know? Were you the hero people were calling you, or were you just lucky? Why was that as important as it became?
At the beginning, Robin, it seemed like just a kind of a con game, people trying to give me compensation for such a dramatic loss. And I didn't buy it. And in my book, heroes are made up of those who make conscious decisions to sacrifice themselves for the benefit of others. My reaction was just that. It was a reflex. It was an instinct. I had no time to think about it. And I didn't really have any training for such a thing either. Unlike a cop or a soldier, I didn't spend days and days projecting such a circumstance. I was a journalist caught in a military moment. And I got up from my seat, I picked up an unknown object, and I flung it for reasons that are not clear to me. And in the months that ensued, it was something that I debated quite a bit, whether or not I had thought I was picking up a rock, for instance, out of curiosity. We had been pelted by rocks in Humvees by street urchins. Or did I know it was a weapon? Did I know it was something dangerous, which I sought to eject for the benefit of all. And for many months, I couldn't really discuss the issue publicly, and I had a hard time privately with friends and family because I was so conflicted about it.
Right. And we'll jump ahead here because towards the end of the book, you do come to some closure with that, but through a therapist. What did he say?
A couple of things. He said that primarily in this case, that one actually acts from unconscious thinking, and this is thoughts which are formed by the environment you're in and you're not even aware of them. And I was going on to my fourth week of full-time embedding with a platoon of the 1st Armored Division, and we were on the front lines of Iraq day in and day out. And the sense is that even though I wasn't a cop or a soldier, I ended up absorbing the kind of calculus they do, and that's probably what did motivate me.
Yeah. Well, this therapist ends up telling you, I don't care if you did it for your needs or for others, you did it. The end result is the same. You saved people's lives. And people who can't be flexible and shift into this higher level of intelligence, which he was telling you did. I mean, someone might have just had a few dull moments of thinking, geez, should I stand up? I don't know. What should I do? Those people who can't change die. What did his saying that to you do for you?
It was enough to satisfy me, to kind of put the final paragraph on the story. And I don't for a moment think of myself as a hero, but I do believe that people can act honorably, and I believe that when presented a dangerous situation, I stood up, and I'm happy about that. I don't much look back at that again with any conflict. Mm-hmm. I feel that I, in a moment of crisis, came through. I use a hook. It is more functional than the silicone hand. Mm-hmm. That's not really why I wear it. Neither of them work great, you know, compared to a hand. And really my left hand is the worker. My right hand is sort of a little bit of a helper now. And it serves as a pretty good paperweight. But I don't wear it for strict functionality. I wear it because I'm proud of it, and I want people to notice it. To be honest with you, I had a great vanity about wearing a pretty boy prosthesis, which was made of silicone. It was very lifelike. It was done by a sculptor, and it was really a sculpture. It cost the Army $15,000, and everyone is equipped with one now. But it began to annoy me because it faked people out. I decided that I didn't want really to disguise my deformity, that I earned it honestly, that there were lives saved because of it, and it was something I could be proud of. And it also is something that connects me with all the war amputees who I went through it with.
Time magazine writer Michael Weisskopf, who came to accept he wasn't a fraud, he was a blood brother. His book, Blood Brothers, Among the Soldiers of Ward 57. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll hear more about the soldiers he met on that ward, from Brockton, Mass., North Carolina. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, back with Michael Weisskopf, author of the book, Blood Brothers, Among the Soldiers of Ward 57. We spoke of your emotional struggles, the soldiers you met on Ward 57 after you lost your right hand when you picked up that grenade that exploded. They had some of their own. There's Pete Damon from right here in Brockton, Massachusetts. He was the helicopter mechanic who lost both arms when a tire blew up. Another mechanic killed in that accident. Luis Rodriguez, a medic, a pit bull of a man who saved so many in the field and then became a victim himself. He lost a leg and part of his hand. And Bobby Isaacs, who lost both of his legs. He was given up for dead. He almost didn't make it out of Iraq. Michael, tell us about them. Pete Damon, for instance, was just tortured with the thought he might have been responsible for someone else's death.
The issue with Pete was whether or not he could have recognized safety problems with the equipment he was using to inflate a helicopter, and the Army believed he could. He should have. As I examined it more closely, he was really framed, that he wasn't responsible for the improper equipment and was probably misled about its safety. But he had not only survivor's guilt, but a great sense of personal culpability in all this. His partner was 19 years old. He was a lovely man from Alabama by the name of Paul Bush. And Pete struggled a great deal with what role he played in Paul's death, as well as the severing of his own two arms. Now, Luis Rodriguez, who lost part of his hand and a leg in a roadside bomb explosion, wanted always to save lives under fire as a combat medic, and worked his way up the Army until he led his own platoon of medics up the desert in Iraq. What he suffered mostly from psychologically was that the world is interwoven and that interdependence was necessary for him to get by. It started out with his need for his kids to help him get water and get his prosthesis, and for instructors to help him learn how to walk anew. And what Rodriguez had learned was that he could walk again in bigger shoes. And what he ended up doing finally was not only serve as a medic, but staying stateside in training medics, allowing many others to be surrogates for him. And now he's a bit of a medic evangelical. He's traveling around the state's army bases, talking about medic techniques.
And then there's Bobby Isaacs. You mentioned that Rod was evangelical in his zeal about training medics. Bobby Isaacs is perhaps the real evangelical. He's a gentle, young, religious Southerner, lost both his legs, and seemed, maybe I've got this wrong, but seemed to be the one who was almost supernaturally accepting of his fate. Whereas, you know, others would have understandable rages when they couldn't lift a toothbrush or whatever. What are you saying about Bobby Isaacs?
No, Bobby has great faith, and it is not only a faith through religion, and he is a fundamentalist Baptist in North Carolina, but a great faith in his ability to move forward in the world, albeit on a pair of prosthetic legs. Bobby endured over 40 surgeries and kept on coming back and kept on coming back, and became a man who was able to give testimony at evangelical churches, where he would talk about the honor and character of the American soldier. So Bobby really learned how to survive by bringing all the elements of the life he loved in the Army into his life as a new civilian.
They, of course, were all changed in other ways, physical ways. But you write of being really changed, shifting priorities. How have you been changed?
It reminds me how life is made up of moments, and how any one moment it can end, and with it all of the love relationships and achievements you've racked up, how fragile it is, and how important it is not to defer important moments for less important things. And I don't miss soccer games of my son or ballet recitals of my daughter. I don't miss opportunities to tell my wife I love her. And I try to put work in perspective now. And at a time, I didn't. At a time, I risked too much for too little.
Michael Weisskopf, the book is Blood Brothers, Among the Soldiers of Ward 57. Just want to ask you one last thing. Did I hear a little sort of electronic buzzing? Is that your hand?
My electronic hook does whirl and make a kind of funny electric noise.
What is that? Can I hear that?
Let me get it on. You can hear it. I'll put it right up to the microphone. You hear that?
Yeah. By the way, you had a wife from whom you were separated with children, and she was invaluable to your recovery, as were they. You also had a
yes.
girlfriend. You've since married Rebecca, your girlfriend. And you write here in the book that you now have a daughter, with her. You write, her right hand is a miniature replica of your own. What do you mean?
Oh, children always inherit features of their parents: ears, nose, feet, and hands. And my little girl Mari ended up inheriting my hands, the same shape of the knuckles and the same shape of the fingers and fingernails. And it was as if I had cloned my right hand. And in fact, it is on Mari, and it gives me hope for the future that she'll be able to use it to write when I can't anymore, and use it to do great things.
Huh. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's Time Magazine correspondent Michael Weisskopf, author of Blood Brothers, Among the Soldiers of Ward 57. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There will be no marching bands, no shiny military vehicles, no men and women in uniform, their service medals pinned proudly to their chests. On Main Street in Wareham, Massachusetts this year, for the first time in 30 years, the annual Veterans Day Parade in Wareham, a small town in the southeastern tip of the state, has been canceled. And for many communities across the country, this is a reminder of what they've already had to do, or a sign of things to come. Joining us is Joseph Napoli. He's a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel with 25 years of service in Korea and Vietnam. He lives in neighboring Marion, Massachusetts, and used to march in the Wareham Parade. Joe, why is the parade being called off?
Well, it's being called off because the dwindling numbers or members of the local veterans groups, the aging population of the veterans, and the younger people, who might be far and few between, are not joining the veterans organizations.
Yeah, and we understand that this parade in Wareham was actually a co-parade with Marion, where you live, and Mattapoisett, another town nearby. So, you know, those two towns already dropped out.
Exactly. Mattapoisett dropped out several years ago, and now Wareham has done the same thing.
Well, I'm wondering, though, sir, we are in a war. We're in a war in Iraq that followed a war in Afghanistan. And I'm wondering, are the returning veterans, are they just not joining? Are they maybe too young yet to join? Or maybe they're not getting to stay home long enough. They're getting deployed back. But, you know, it would seem that there would be new veterans.
Well, that brings up a different point. We don't have as many veterans in the local community here that are serving. That's part of the disconnect that our society is experiencing. With a lack of draft, we've become disconnected from our military. I think from the town of Marion, we have currently 8 people on active duty.
We've been hearing that the military, especially because there is no draft across the board, is more and more become an island separate from the country itself.
Exactly. Yeah. I think so. And I think that's wrong. In my service, I served with none other than the best the society ever produced, and that was the citizen soldier who was drafted, came in with an attitude that I'm going to do the best I can and get out of here as fast as I can.
Well, Joe Napoli, tell us about the parades of the past, you know, the ones that you remember. What were some of the good days like?
You know, I can remember my dad taking me to the parade as a little tot. We used to have grand parades.
Can you describe it for us?
Oh, sure. They were, you know, all the veterans used to march. They used to wear their World War II uniform. They had old military vehicles. They had school marching bands. Everybody turned out for those parades. It was just a big, great, patriotic showing, and people enjoyed it. And it was a day off.
What you described that great parade that you saw as a tot, what did it feel like when you grew up and you got to march in one?
Well, I felt a sense of pride carrying on my dad's tradition, and my 3 older brothers who fought in World War II, they marched, and I marched along with them whenever I possibly could, because I was in the Army for 25 years, most of which were overseas. And then I saw a downtrend when we came back from Vietnam. We were greeted with rocks. We were pelted with everything that we possibly could get, they could get in their hands on. Mm. And that was a sad situation. And I don't, I hate to even think of it, I don't really enjoy them coming, because it's a reminder of those things that we want to forget.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the kids that we left behind.
Yeah. So you're saying it's also a sad thing if you have the parade.
You know, it's a bittersweet sort of thing. You enjoy the fact that they're honoring those individuals who gave us our freedom, but by the same token, you know that it's a reminder that John Wright's and Mike Wright's and John Hess, they didn't come back with me. You know, those are the things that run through our minds.
Yeah. Well, it's a somber day, and I wish you well with it.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Yeah, and God bless you, too.
Well, while there will be no parade this year, tomorrow Wareham will mark Veterans Day with a ceremony at the World War II Memorial outside Town Hall. At precisely 11 a.m., an ROTC unit will raise the flag to signify the end of World War I, which ended on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. It was the war to end all wars. Well, we want to take a minute to air some of your thoughts on a recent segment, and it seems appropriate today given we heard from so many veterans. Our segment was on the 68th anniversary of the first national performance of Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. It was played by the MBC Orchestra. You're listening to some of it. It's become something of a national funeral dirge, played after the assassination of JFK and in the war film Platoon. Well, Brett Mason wrote, "I'm embarrassed to admit that I never took the time to learn who the composer of this piece was, despite my introduction to it via the film Platoon. As a Vietnam veteran, I continue to find it arousing the same strong emotional response. Your segment helped me to learn how the piece was composed, and the excerpts moved me to tears unexpectedly in the middle of the day." Well, we learn from biographer Barbara Heyman that Samuel Barber was actually in a joyful mood when he wrote the piece. Composer Virgil Thompson even suggested it would be known as Music to Make Love To, which prompted Laura Aiken to write with this story. "My mother, Judith Haynes, was the stage lighting designer for a ballet choreographer, Michael Lopezansky, who was given permission by composer Barber to use this music for a ballet in the late 60s. It was called Through the Edge. The ballet was composed for two couples. One was in street dress, but the other was in silvery, gray-green leotards and was meant to represent the unsaid desires of the first couple. We've always loved the music, as did my mother. I wasn't aware that it had been used for the Kennedy funeral and others until I heard your piece. Well, Mom was in the choir of a local Episcopal church for 25 years, although she was Jewish. When she was killed by a drunk driver in 1993, the choir joined us at our services and later honored her at their church service, which the organist opened with Adagio for Strings. My sister and I were astonished to find out that he chose it on his own without knowing her connection to the music. Well, now this music truly does symbolize both desire and loss for us." We'd love to hear your thoughts on anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now. Abruptly changing Changing moods. That sound can only mean one thing. It's time to talk soccer. And though you might not know it, there's a championship game going on this weekend. The New England Revolution will face off against the Houston Dynamos on Sunday for the right to lay claim to the U.S. Major League Soccer Cup. Here to talk about that and about the rest of the news from the world of sport, Only a Game host and resident soccer fan Bill Littlefield, who's been humming this song.
Absolutely. For months, but it's finally appropriate now.
Now, okay, we read that the New England Revs have been on something of a roll in the late season. That's carried them through a successful postseason. Is it going to hold out for them?
Well, I think it very well might. And this is, of course, Steve Nichol, the coach of the Revolution, has managed to do this apparently every season he's been here. He manages to get this team rolling in the last 6, 7, 8 weeks of the season. This season is no exception, and they look very strong going into the final.
Okay, here's the question you wrote for me to ask you. Gee, Bill, even without offensive starter Clint Dempsey, who's a likely no-show on Sunday because of a sprained ankle?
Yeah, well, when I wrote that question, Robin, Clint Dempsey was in the doubtful column, but he practiced a bit this week, and so he may be, in fact, available on Sunday, which would be even better for the Revolution. They've had to play, you know, they've had to kind of shuffle the deck and replace him, but they may actually have him available.
Oh, well, looking back on the whole Major League Soccer season, highlights for you?
Well, from my very parochial point of view, last week's conference championship game in which goalie Matt Reese not only stopped a couple of shots, penalty shots, but also scored one. You don't see the goalie score very often.
How did he do that?
Well, he took his turn with the guys who took the penalty shots. And somebody explained to me later, I thought it was unusual too, and somebody explained to me, you know, goalies practice penalty shots against each other all the time. And so there was really no doubt that he would pop his into the net.
And he'd be really good. I thought he blocked a goal and then...
Then threw it in.
Something. Moving on to college football. Pretty big upset yesterday. Number 13 Rutgers beat number 3-ranked Louisville. Mm-hmm. Both teams previously undefeated. Now there's talk that Rutgers could end up playing for the national title. Is this a surprise?
Well, a number of incredibly unlikely things would have to happen for Rutgers to play for the national title. But Rutgers is back in the bowl championship series picture, and this is quite a remarkable thing.
Is it like pigs flying in that category? Or?
Somewhere around there. I mean, at only a game, we like to say that Rutgers is playing its first meaningful football game in 136 years. So that'll give you some idea.
Well, speaking of undefeated teams as those were, in pro football, the AFC's Indianapolis Colts are 8-0 going into this weekend. The only undefeated team in the NFL? Is that...
Well, they are, and there is not to say they're the only very successful team. They aren't, and there are some interesting games this weekend. The Bears, we'll see how good the Bears are when they play the Giants this weekend, Sunday night. But, yeah, the Colts are atop of the pile right now.
And how are the playoffs shaping up, just to give us a little...
Well, the one thing we know for sure is that the Steelers will not have an opportunity to defend their Super Bowl title. I believe they're 2-6. They're not even going to make the playoffs unless something incredibly topsy-turvy occurs between now and the end of the season. Otherwise, parity reigns as usual in the National Football League, and any number of teams, at least 6 to 8, seem poised to follow the Steelers.
Are the Patriots anywhere near the top?
Why not? They're on top of their division. They've won 6 games. You know, they lost to the Colts, but nearly everybody has lost to the Colts.
Well, pull up that bandwagon. Just before we let you go, I want to just mention Michelle Kwan, the lovely figure skater, who's won 9 national, 5 world titles, never won an Olympic gold. She had a withdrawal this year. Oh. Tearful because she was injured. But she has a new job.
She's sorry to upset you. Her new job is to go first to China and then all around the rest of the world telling people that America is a place where anything is possible, except perhaps winning an Olympic gold medal. And I'm sure she'll be very good at it.
She's working for Condoleezza Rice.
Yes.
She's going to be a U.S. public diplomacy envoy.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a story there. Bill Littlefield.
I look forward to seeing what she has to say.
That's right. Bill Littlefield will be covering all the college sports and the Chicago Bulls a whole lot more this week on Only a Game, so don't miss that. Bill, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Bill Frisell has been called the Clark Kent of the electric guitar, transforming from a soft-spoken conversationalist into a creative dynamo. Frizzell leaps over genres in a single bound. He's composed scores for Buster Keaton and Wim Wenders films, collaborated with the L.A. Philharmonic and Marianne Faithfull, interpreted songs by Bob Dylan, Madonna, and others, from the Foo Fighters to Henry Mancini to Hank Williams. That song is from a new CD with some old friends. In fact, it's called Bill Frizzell, Ron Carter, Paul Motion. Ron Carter being the bassist, Paul Motion the drummer. And Bill Frizzell is also touring right now with the Unspeakable Orchestra. They were featured on his Unspeakable CD, a mix of jazz, electronica, and funk sounds that were compared to Miles Davis in the Electric Years, and won a Grammy for Best Contemporary Jazz Album of 2005. Bill Frizzell joins us now from Seattle. Superman, indeed. Welcome.
How's it going over there?
It's fine. We've spoken before here on the program, and you speak so many different languages through your instrument, through the guitar. I mean, sort of doing everything, country, folk, sort of a whole new kind of fusion of sounds. And yet, how comfortable are you with just talking?
That's a little rough for me, actually. Now, I really feel like my voice is more with the music. That's where I can really express myself. I recently heard from a quote where they said that music picks up where language leaves off, and that made a lot of sense to me.
Well, let's hear some of that music. This is from Unspeakable. That's the CD that won the Grammy for Best Contemporary Jazz Album 2005. How about we listen to Hymn for Ginsberg, poet and Howl author Allen Ginsberg. What were you trying to capture of him?
Well, he's someone that I met, actually, this was in the mid-80s, I guess, when I first met Allen and got to work on one of his albums. Like, well, he would read the poems and we'd make music to go with it, and it seemed to fit with some of my feelings about Allen.
Let's listen a little. Well, and so there's that sweet poetic sound for Allen Ginsberg, or reminiscent of Allen Ginsberg for you. And then, of course, there's Alias. Let's listen to that. Idea of the range. Where did this song come from?
Well, actually, it's Elias, who is the percussionist on this song.
Oh, no.
And I named that for Don Elias. And sadly, he pass away, you know, after this album, but the song was named for him when he was still around. Just because he brought so much, you know, he always would bring the level of whatever was going on, he'd bring it up another notch, and he sure did on that.
So, Elias from Bill Frisell. I want to read you something you said to the Village Voice. You said, I like to have fun when I play, and I like comedy, but it's not a conscious thing. I'm basically a pretty shy person. I don't dance or get into fights. But there are all these things inside me that get out when I perform. What gets out when you perform? What are some of those real things?
That's what's so incredible about music or all kinds of art forms. I mean, I think that's where we're able to just do. There's no limits on what you can do or whatever's in your imagination. It's all possible, and it doesn't, you're not hurting anybody when you're doing it. I recently saw this documentary on Bruce Bickford. He's an animator who he worked with Frank Zappa in the 60s and 70s, and he makes these just fantastic claymation animated films. And he said something where, doesn't everybody know that animation is the most important thing in the world? You know, he has these stories with wars and big battles going on and all that stuff, and he talks about how he gets to work it all out in the art and not in real life.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
So if we see Bill Frisell sitting quietly in that sort of Clark Kent way that you have on the stage, in your head it might be action figures.
Could be.
Well, give us a song, Bill Frisell, that's sort of the real Bill Frisell that we can end with. That speaks really to you.
Uh-oh. You mean something that I should choose?
Yeah, you choose something that is who you think that's closest to what's going on in your head, at least most of the time.
Boy, I mean, that's where I really have trouble committing to any one thing. I mean, it's just, it all goes together. So I'm sort of dodging the question.
That's okay. Bill Frisell, what do you like in the grocery store, the paper plastic part?
Well, I usually get paper, but sometimes you need plastic.
That's right.
Too.
Phil Frisell, on tour with the Unspeakable Orchestra. His most recent CD is with a trio, however. It's called Bill Frisell, Ron Carter, Paul Motion. And by the way, for more on the tour, you can go to our website, here-now.org. We'll let you know where Bill will be. Bill, I'm going to let you get back to your music.
Thanks a lot. It's good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. And Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugars is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Kevin Donovan. Our intern, Katie Falcigno. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Enjoy your Veteran Day and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.